We turn to 2 Kings, chapter 13, verses 14 to verse 19. And we're bringing our time with Elisha to a close, and we come now to look this morning at the death of Elisha. It has been a very eventful life. And yet regarding the time of one's death, we have very little to say and very little control. We read our times, they are in God's hands. That it is appointed unto man once to die, because after that the judgment. And in Psalm 139, in your book, they were all written before ever there was one of them. The days that were assigned for me. So our times, they are with God, and regarding the timing of death. And then also regarding the circumstances of death, we have very little control. Elijah is caught up into the heavens in a chariot of fire. It's a very dramatic, awe-inspiring exit from a scene of labours here on earth. But for Elisha, it will be with a diseased, ravaged body that he makes his way to the grave, and he will lay down his spirit. So, very, very different. Yet, it is all with God and in the hands of God. However, what we can say is that we do have something to contribute, and in a measure can be in control of the way in which we die, not necessarily the time or the circumstance, but the way or the spirit in which we die. And for many, it is a time of regret, a time of pain, anguish, a time of apprehension, fear. But what was this time like for Elisha? Well, it was a time of service, right to the very last, right to the very last. To his last breath, he is serving God. He exists to be a voice for God to the very last. And we think of Romans 14, verse 7. None of us lives to himself, and none dies to himself. Whether we live unto the Lord, or whether we die unto the Lord. Therefore, we live or die, we are the Lord's. We are the Lord's. So our death itself is as much as an offering to God, a time of service to God, as our very life. And Richard Baxter, who was a Puritan ministering in Kidderminster, a time when the local vicar was more often drunk than not, and he employed Baxter as a curate. And Baxter transformed Kidderminster with his preaching, that had built five galleries. And there's a great monument even now in Kidderminster dominating the town of Richard Baxter. And he felt he was dying very, very young. He'd be vomiting blood. And he had a saying, "I preach as a dying man to dying men as an heir to preach again." And that's how he entered the pulpit. "I preach as a dying man to dying men as an heir to preach again." And we'll sing a hymn of his to close later in the service. And the words of that hymn sum up his life. "Lord, it belongs not to my care whether I die or live. To love and serve thee is my share, and this thy grace must give." And that's how Baxter faced death itself. It is all ours unto the Lord. And we sing, don't we, "Happy if with my latest breath I may but gasp his name, preach him to all and cry in death, behold, behold the Lamb." And that's the sort of spirit we see in Elisha here. So what do we see then regarding death when we look at Elisha's time of death? Well, first of all, we have to note that it is a time of loss, time of great loss, because Joash, the king of Israel, not to confuse him with another Joash, king of Judah, they had same names, just like today we have names that are common, and so also then. This is the king of Israel. Joash, the king of Israel, who was vain and could be quite ruthless, rebellious in terms of God, hears news about Elisha's illness, and he decides to pay him a visit. And it's not just a routine or a customary visit, but he comes deeply concerned, with a sense of great loss, so much so he cannot fight back the tears. And we have a very moving, very tender scene of Joash, this hardened, stubborn, wicked king, weeping over Elisha at the prospect of Elisha's death. Now, Elisha had been a source of irritation. He had been very much an annoyance. He was what Joash would have regarded as a disturber of the peace. He was like the voice of God. He was like an inner conscience, the conscience of the nation. And yet for all of that, in a godless age, yet still, the nation apart from Elisha is unthinkable. And it's not just a sense of national loss, but also of personal loss for Joash. And it is remarkable that a king should even be here at this time in these circumstances. There was Louis, Louis, King of France, who gave orders that death was never to be mentioned in his presence. Never to be mentioned. And then Catherine, the Empress of Russia, she forbade that funeral processions never made their way down the streets near to the palace. More than that, she insisted all burials were conducted at night. And so the very thought of death is pushed away and out of their mind. Nothing at all to do with death or a sense of mortality, and that this life will come to an end. What a contrast, isn't it, to Queen Wilhelmina of the Netherlands. Queen Wilhelmina, she gave instructions regarding her funeral that all the dignitaries, royal members, were to be clothed in white, and that with the cortege, the soldiers were to march to Jesu, lover of my soul, and a coffin was to be lowered to "There is sunshine in my heart today." What a difference, isn't it? Here is one who knows the Lord, and death itself is not a sense of loss or mourning, but rather a time of celebration. But of course, for so many people, death is a time of loss. It's the loss of loved ones, loss of health, loss of independence, loss of position, loss of all that is familiar. At the end, the loss of the very body in which we entered into this world. Death can only be seen in terms of loss. And even for the believer, to an extent, there are tears and there is grief, and the sense of loss is acknowledged. "We do grieve," says Scripture. We do grieve. Not as those without hope. Not as those that hope, but we do grieve. But there is a difference in our grief. It's a process we work through. We turn more and more to the Lord. And for the believer, while it can be a time of loss, it is nevertheless a time of gain. And Paul could say, couldn't he, "For me to die is gain." It is gain, inestimable gain. He could write, "To be absent from this body is present with the Lord." The Lord in whose presence there is fullness of joy, at whose right hand there are pleasures forevermore. It was C.S. Lewis, wasn't it, that once wrote, he dreamt, he longed to be at that place where all the beauty and the wonder of the earth comes from. Wants to get there to the source, you know. And I think when I was a young lad and living in Clitheroe, the Clitheroe River at the back of the house, I wanted to get to the source, and way up there in the Barren Mountains, and coming to that little source of the river where we swam and so on. And but how disappointing, a little piddling little stream, so unimpressive. But God is the glorious fount of all blessing, and to be in his presence and to know him in a way that is unveiled, to see him in a way we cannot see him by the eye of faith, it is something wonderful and truly glorious. And so Paul writes, "Our light afflictions, And Paul knew all about afflictions. He knew about stoning and flogging and imprisonments. He knew about what it was to be maligned and misrepresented. He knew all the cares of the churches. And yet Paul says what? Our light afflictions are but for a moment, and they are working for us a far more exceeding eternal weight of glory. And so Paul saw everything that he went through as momentary, and more than that, preparatory. It was preparing for something more glorious and wonderful. And, there's a book I'm reading at the moment by William Jay, and he's dealing with a Christian. He deals with a Christian in Christ, and as it were, in the Spirit, and then the Christian in the church and in the home and in work, and then in affliction and sorrow, in joy, and then in death, in the grave, in glory. And when William Jay comes to that thought of glory, William Jay was the minister who was in Bath in the 1800s, who Spurgeon modelled his own ministry on, this little stone mason, never been to college, ministering, a mighty ministry in Bath. But he writes then, well, how is heaven put before us in Scripture? Well, it's put before us negatively. Here is darkness, there is light, you know, and here is sorrow, there is joy. And in terms of bodies, this is mortal, that is immortal. This is corruptible, that is incorruptible. It's put for us negatively. It is the opposite of all that we know here. We have hardship and disappointment and trials. And then he says it's put forward then figuratively. It's like a realm, it's like a country, it's like a city, and so on. It's like a banquet, a feast. Imagery is drawn upon to convey something of the wonder of something glorious yet before us as God's people. And then it's put before us comparatively, and how it's worked from the lesser to the greater. And what we know of blessing here is nothing to compare with what we yet shall know. Eye has not seen nor ear heard, hasn't entered into the heart of man, the things that God's prepared for them that love him. And so for the believer, yes, there is a sense of loss, but that is counterbalanced by a sense of gain. And that is why, of course, Wesley could say about the Methodists, couldn't he? Our people die well. They die well. But that wasn't the case for Wesley at one point. When he was travelling to America and in the midst of a great and mighty storm, and he met these Moravians, who had a personal walk with God and were celebrating being children of God at a grasp of the new birth. And he couldn't get over how their children were so calm in the midst of the storm and so at peace and that they weren't afraid of death. And it searched him, it challenged him. And then, of course, there came that time with Wesley when he said, I exchanged the faith of a servant for the faith of a son. And it all rests on that, doesn't it? If children then heirs, and heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ, it all rests on knowing here that we are children of God. And so it's something glorious. And while this is tinged with sorrow and loss, it is yet something also of gain. There's two favourite books I have in the house. I ask everybody about them, all the Welsh ministers I come across. Nobody can tell me anything of their background, but they are just so, so precious to me. The one is called The Welsh Hillside Saints, and the other is The Old Welsh Evangelist, and it's all in poetry. And if you love poetry, well, you're away with us if you love poetry. And what he does, he's in the time of revival. And he's writing in the times of when this chapel would have been built, the Calvinistic Methodists. He's in that time and he's of that ilk. And he's writing of societies, when you had these societies that sprang up everywhere before the chapels were built. And you could belong to a society. If you were a God-fearer, you could belong. And they shared, they had this society of meetings where they would share together. And it just paints a beautiful picture of God's people up in the hills, where they are walking with God and they're sharing together in the things of God. And in this particular meeting that he's describing, they have just buried one of their own. They've just laid him to rest in the hills. And they now gather in the night, and they're reflecting together, and they're sharing together of what that meant. And then one begins the meeting, and he says, "I ask myself, is this the end of man? This dismal, uncompanionable hole? Can this cold trench that measures but a span, in its poor space, forever hold a soul?" So that's how the meeting begins. And then an old man gets up, and then he has his contribution. And he says, "A few days more, and friends shall lay this frame to rest in peace beneath the sheltering sod. But I will go on an unexpired flame, unquenched by death, to burn beside my God." And there's that assurance of leaving the earth and into heaven and being in the company of God. And then another gets up and he says, "When on the hills this day we laid his dust and dropped our tears o'er his crumbling frame, we felt he was not there, but with the just, a new star risen, clothed in deathless flame." And then he goes on, he can't stop himself, he goes on from this, and he says, "Our low horizons he has climbed above, has left behind its mist, its cloud, its night, and circles now around the Son of Love, robed in garments of eternal light." And there's the conflict, isn't there? On the one hand, we do grieve. There is a sense of loss, but not as those without hope. We have been begotten again unto a living hope by the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance that is incorruptible, undefiled, that fades not away, reserved in heaven for you who are kept by the power of God through faith unto salvation, waiting to be unveiled at the last time. And that's our hope. And so, yes, there's a tenderness, and we value one another, and there's a sense of loss, but not as those without hope. And so for Elisha, yes, there's a sense of loss here and tears on the part of Joash, but what comfort is there for him? Now, also we see death here, secondly, as a time of challenge. Because, you know, Elisha does something quite strange here, and it's in the form of a parable. It's something that is acted out. There's a sense of drama here. It's a very intense moment. And with a firmness and a sense of vigor, he grasps Joash's hands, the king's hands, and says, "Get a bow, and then get some arrows, fling open the windows, and shoot." And he's impressing upon Joash that, yes, he's to be engaged in battle and conflict, but it is with the Lord. And the Lord, if he will but look to the Lord, will be with him and will assist him and will bless him. And so what Elisha is doing here, he is redirecting the attention or focus from himself, who must go the way of all the earth, to God, who is the ever-living God. "You are weeping over me. You should be looking unto God." That's what's happening here. You should be looking unto God in this situation and all the challenges that you will face, that God will not fail you if you but look to him. And so it's a tremendous challenge to be up and doing, a sense of endeavor, to set out anew with God. And it's the note of victory and triumph that is announced here on the part of Elisha or Joash. How different things could be for you if at this moment, at this time, you stepped out anew with God. And so this time, so solemn, so serious, is a time of great challenge for Joash. And death is like that, isn't it? Death is a challenge, and the death of God's people is a challenge to us. Clearly those that have served and those that have been faithful. and those that are taken, gaps that are left. What a challenge! God's people, the way they have lived, the way they have served, the time they have given, the spirit they have shown. What a challenge that is when that is laid in the ground. And now who replaces? We bear the torch that flaming fell from the hands of those who gave their lives proclaiming Jesus died and rose. There's that sense of challenge. Where are we in terms of our lives, in terms of our service, in terms of our time, in terms of our walk with God, in terms of this Christian life into which we've been brought by grace? What are we doing with our time? What are we doing with our abilities? What are we doing with the life that is yet remaining to us? And Paul has a similar spirit with Timothy, doesn't he? As Paul is now aging in years and the end is near, I have fought a good fight. It's like it's almost over. Oh, Timothy, endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. Timothy, you need to toughen up, Timothy. You know, toughen up. And Timothy's quite refined and he's quite introspective and quite diffident in spirit. But, oh, Paul is saying you're to rise above all of these things. To serve God and be all that you can be for God. And those words, I charge you as before God. I charge you. And there's that word of challenge that is given at the very last with Paul. And of course, when the saints of God are taken, what a challenge, isn't it? We were back in Bethany last Sunday, ministered there down near the Mumbles in Swansea. And dear people there, dear, that are now in glory. And, you know, there's those words in that psalm, isn't it? I thought of former days. And the years of long ago, it's a bit like that, very nostalgic being back there. But we had such dear, dear people, such sweet people. We're in glory now. And just the remembrance of them is a challenge. And a challenge, isn't it, to a spirit of lethargy, inactivity, spirit of mediocrity, passivity. What a challenge. Those that are dear to the Lord and dear to the church when they are taken away. Josh, don't weep over me. Just see what you could be in God, through God, by God. The time remaining for you. Is not this time for change, for you to be up and doing and for endeavor, Josh? So it's a time, yes, of sorrow. It's a time also of challenge. And also, thirdly, it's a time of rebuke. Because what happens here is this, that Elisha then grasps Joash's hands with the arrows that remain and says to Joash, strike the ground. And Joash strikes the ground three times, but obviously there's something deeply significant going on here for Elisha to be so angry. Elisha is indignant with Joash. And why is that? I tend to feel when you read into the narrative that perhaps Joash is just going along and humouring a very weak and a sick and a frail and a dying old man. And is he just humouring Elisha? His spirit isn't really in this. He's not really with Elisha in all of this that's happening. And Elisha is angry with Joash because he could have known so much more. So much more. And he says that to him. Oh, if only, how much more would you have conquered? What victories you would have known? And it's as though Joash failed to rise to this occasion. Fail to rise to this occasion. And there are occasions, aren't there? We're thinking of a new pastor. We're thinking of a new beginning for the church. We're thinking of this community. There are times that challenge. There are times that cry out to us to rise to the occasion. There are times like that in the life of the church. And so for Joash, what do we read? According to your faith. Be it unto you, How much do you really take God at his word? How much do you really want to cast yourself out upon him and venture all on him? What of your faith? According to your faith, be it unto you. Remember the prophet's words to the king, isn't it? The Lord is able to give you far, far more than this. Far more than this. Be able to know far more than this. Open your mouth wide, very, and I will fill it. See if I will not open the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, come the words, isn't it? God's readiness, God's willingness to give yet more, to do yet more, to bless us in a greater way. God's readiness and willingness. But the rebuke here to Joash is that he failed to rise to this occasion and get into the spirit of the moment and all that was really demanded of him, that his eyes were shifted from Elisha unto God and all that lay before. Such a word of rebuke. Oh, Joash. Elisha's saying, in effect, you need to look to God more. You need to trust in God more. You need to prove God more. You need to delight in God more. To try him through God more. And all those words that come and challenge our hearts in terms of where we are with the Lord is the rebuke that we settle like Joash for so little. Settle for so little. So little Bible reading. So little by way of times of prayer, so little in terms of sweet seasons of communion with God, so little in terms of church attendance and the means of grace, so little by way of development and growth and change, so little by way of usefulness and effectiveness by way of Christian life, so little by way of the experiences of a life in the Spirit, so little by way of devotion to Christ, so little by way of a sense of heaven and its glory. A word of rebuke when a saint is dying and expires and breathes the last and leaves this world and lays down this body. Do you know what's quite incredible? A thought, really. You will never, ever, ever, ever walk through a fallen world again. Ever. You will never live amongst fallen, lost, benighted souls again. Ever. You will never be tested by way of trust in God, reliance on him, devotion to him, ever, as you are now. The opportunities that are given to us while breath lasts. There's a verse just coming to me, I can't remember. So why life and thought and being last, isn't it? Pray shall employ my, then my nobler powers, isn't it? But now, while life and thought and being last, and a life of devotion and praise to God, one serious thought of death can do more good for us than 100 sermons. When we face a mortality, that time is limited, time is short, time is passing, time is uncertain. To treasure moments and live in the moment with God, for God, wherever God has placed us. You know, there are people, they wish their lives away, don't they? Once I'm over this now, and once I'm through that now, and once I'm, rather than seizing each day as a gift from God to be lived as unto God in his glory. We'll sing a hymn before we come to the Lord's table. And it is that hymn by Richard Baxter. At one point when he thought he was dying, it's number 798, he was away from home, laid up with sickness, thought he was facing his last, and he got his Bible, his concordance, and he put down his thoughts, and they became expanded on, and it became a Christian classic. It's called The Saints' Everlasting Rest. And really this sums up his whole spirit, his life, 798. Lord, it belongs not to my care whether I die or live. To love and serve thee is my share, and this your grace must give. Number 798.